I'm your host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to Alchemy, the podcast all about building a business on the front lines of the new economy.
Welcome back to this week's episode of Alchemy. Very excited to welcome Gary Seelhorst. He is the Senior VP of National Compliance and Government Affairs. He's with Justice Cannabis. Gary, great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad that I was able to nail you down. I know both of us have been traveling quite a bit. For everybody who is tuning in right now, and if you haven't heard of Justice, they are a private multi-state operator in the U.S. and really kind of founded on the premise of, they say, feeling good is always the destination. You know, Justice has a really great background, reputation for very high quality products. Very unique dispensaries, and excited to have Gary on the show today. He's a busy guy. Aside from his role at Justice, he's actually a chairperson of policy at the New Jersey Cannabis Trade Association. He's also a treasurer at the Utah Cannabis Association. He's a policy council executive at NCIA and has a really great background. Prior to Justice, he was a chief compliance and government affairs at Flora. He was also in biz dev at a number of companies. He was chief business officer at Simple Surgical. And Gary, I think maybe a really great way of kind of going into the show is you have this experience and background both from pharma and biotech. And obviously, I think that probably helped, you know, prep your intro into the cannabis industry. So maybe talk a little bit about that and you know, how that really helped you and what you're doing today.
Yeah, absolutely. Congrats on you know, getting all that straight too. I know there's a lot of different titles under my name. A lot of them are sort of voluntary titles, especially with a lot of the associations and the industry trade groups that I'm involved in. And saying my last name correctly too. So I do have kind of a unique background where I started in the pharmaceutical industry. I originally was a medical writer. I'd gone to grad school. And sort of had this master's in biochem. I didn't really know what to do with it. And then I was in Indiana. I ended up getting a job with Eli Lilly in Indianapolis and started kind of off, you know, in my pharmaceutical career. I spent most of my time probably in clinical development, doing a lot of later stage human trials. And then I ended up getting my master's degree in business administration with an emphasis in finance. And I started to kind of move this. I was actually at Pfizer at the time, wow. You know, of latest repute with the COVID vaccination and everything. So, but it was a good company to work for at the time. I got to spend a lot of time in different departments. One of which was corporate compliance and corporate development. And that actually afforded me the opportunity to get involved in some of the policy work that was going on at the time. So just to kind of give you an example, so I spent some time with the PACs out there, PAC, the political action committees. And it was an interesting time. This is probably, you know, around like the early 2000s. And there was, you know, in some of the political campaigns, you started to hear rumblings of, you know, the big bad pharma. And there's certainly, you know, that component to it, especially with, you know, sort of the opioid crisis and everything. But outside of that, I really wasn't, I was pretty impressed with how well aligned everyone was in the pharmaceutical industry. So so that was something that was very, you know, it was heartening to see that, with the exception of, you know, the sort of, you know, the opioids, you had the Purdue Pharmas and stuff like that, where we tended to divert as far as what our specific goals were. But that's when I first started getting involved in sort of the compliance part of it and sort of the government affairs as well. And so after that experience was a very sort of serendipitous trip for me, because I was working with a lot of startups trying to get them funded, because I just sort of opened up my own shop. And I had a lot of pretty good inroads with a lot of the folks in the life science finance space. So venture capital funds, private equity, you know, hedge funds, stuff like that. And someone had approached me to help to syndicate a round of funding for this Flora, California, which you had mentioned before. And I said, sure, why not? But in me doing a lot of my diligence, what I want to do is really have a better understanding of where the regulations are going and how a lot of the policy is being driven, because I knew it was different from state to state, but I just didn't realize like how much, you know, it was going to diverge, you know, when you're looking at a lot of these different territories. So I did some lobbying up in Sacramento, because that's where I'm from, California. So I met with three different legislators and I got three different answers on where the whole cannabis industry was going. And that's, you know, it's about par for the course when you meet a lot of the legislators at the different states, because some of them have really dug in, some know a lot, and some really don't. And some don't even care to. I've been virtually kicked out of some offices just because they're very conservative and they don't like the optics of anything cannabis related. So I got a good dose of policy, you know, just at the state level in California, and helped me to really have a better understanding of where cannabis was going, more importantly. So, you know, and California is sort of a unique state in that, you know, it's very mature from a cannabis perspective, but, you know, it's a tough state to really, you know, make a profit in, just because of the, you know, the really high taxes and the operations. And there's a lot of language in the state policy about, you know, trying to, you know, sort of cater a little bit more to the smaller operator, but interesting enough, you know, you can't really make a profit unless you can scale. So, sort of a little bit of a dichotomy there. So that's how I kind of came from the pharmaceutical industry, which it actually helped out once I got into the multi-state arena, because virtually half of the states that we're in are still at the medical stage. So, you know, these are patients, you know, they have indications, you know, and they're going through treatment. I was, you know, sort of 20 years of my work before was really dealing with, you know, patients and testing hypotheses and looking at the right types of, you know, routes of administration, the types of doses, and, you know, the types of excipients that we were offering up, which is essentially what a lot of these pharmacists do at the different states when they're treating patients. So I have a very good understanding of what they're doing and why they're doing it.
So Gary, I think, you know, one of the things that I definitely was very interested in talking to you about is, you know, mm-hmm. you're obviously, you know, implementing compliance programs across many different states, right? And so, I think there's a whole secondary episode that could be, you know, the run-ins mm-hmm. that you've had, you know, or you might've been kicked out. I think those would make for good fodder, but, you know, obviously working with a lot of government officials, working with lobbying groups, you know, I kind of look at what you're doing is you're really out there mm-hmm. trying to help educate and help write the policy, you know, both on the state and federal level. Yeah. You know, when you're talking about your day-to-day and key responsibilities at Justice, like, how do those overlap?
Yeah, so the way I kind of look at compliance and government affairs, it's sort of like, you know, it's kind of a continuum, where, you know, the compliance is sort of the manifestation of the government affairs work that you're doing. And so what you're doing with government affairs, you know, sometimes some of the work that I do is in states like, say, like Missouri right now, or very recently, New Jersey, where New Jersey transitioned from medical to adult use, or they call it personal use in New Jersey. And then it looks like Missouri is going to be doing the same thing. They just got it on the ballot. So they've been a medical state, they've been a pretty robust medical state. And they're going through that transition. And it's what happens at that point is typically, so you'll have a medical program, and that is usually run by, say, the Department of Health, just because of the nature of what they're doing. You know, obviously it's patient related and has to do with health and human services and folks of that nature that oversee it. But when it makes that transition to recreational, adult use, personal use, however you want to term it, usually what happens is there's a brand new agency that takes over all of the oversight of it. And sometimes they do that rather seamlessly, and sometimes, you know, not so much. And interestingly enough, not many of the people will transition from that previous, you know, regime. and so you still have a lot of folks that you're bringing along and educating, just like you had said. So just take, for instance, you know, New Jersey that just went personal use, and, you know, there was a new commission that was formed. It's called the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, the CRC. and they had five commissioners that were appointed, and they all were, you know, were kind of green in cannabis and not the good green. I mean, they were naive, and what they ended up doing, which I was happy that they did, was to really, you know, start to understand the business more by going on visits with a lot of the operators, and then really starting to ask questions as well on what they did, you know, what it was that they're trying to accomplish, and more importantly, I think what were some of the roadblocks that they were running into, and then you typically will see a, you know, legislation change as well, and so you want to make sure that you're taking a lot of the learnings that you have from other states. And that's why I think people like to have me on a lot of their trade associations, because I live through California and I can tell them, like you said, look, you know, I've seen that movie before when they transition to adult use. And mm-hmm. I've seen the cast of characters that make for, you know, a happy ending and kind of a sad ending. So, you know, these are the things that I've noticed, and I'd like to have those incorporated going forward. Sometimes they listen, sometimes not, because there's a lot of politics involved going forward as well. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting situation. I think one of the things that we've been seeing a lot of, and rightly so, is an incorporation of a social equity policy. And sometimes that'll be driven by the state. And then sometimes the states will take a bit more passive approach to it. And it kind of depends on, you know, a lot of the legislators that were involved in drafting the policy as well. And I think, you know, it works well. So it's really big in, say, like New York, New Jersey, some of the folk, the places on the East Coast, they're putting a big emphasis on social equity, which is great. But it's not always a one size fits all policy too. It kind of depends on, you know, the company. Is it a multi-state company? You know, is it a company that has, you know, a specific community that it builds their operations out of? You know, you can see like you want to incorporate yourself into the community as much as you can. Mm-hmm. And you want to hire from that community. And sometimes, you know, if you're in rural Illinois, you know, it's going to be a lot different than if you're in sort of downtown Trenton, New Jersey. So, you want to make sure that that's, you know, your social equity policy is in line with the community that you're trying to ingratiate yourself into. And sometimes it's not always apparent to the state exactly what that is. And so I've been pretty well involved in drafting a lot of the corporate social responsibility policies, not only just with our company, but with a lot of the trade groups as they kind of enter into that stage in the recreational use. So you want to make sure you get that right, but you also want to make sure you're not setting yourself up for failure either. So a lot of companies like to sort of put forward their own social equity policy to the state or to the, you know, the municipality and say, hey, this is what we want to do. We want to make sure we're hiring, you know, the adversely affected by the war on drugs folks. You know, and you can do that. You know, hiring is great. Some of the states like to allocate social equity licenses, set those aside. Some people, like, you know, what our group in New Jersey does is we set aside monies that help to expunge records for folks. So it's, you know, it's a lot of different stuff to a lot of, you know, different people. So you do what you're capable of, but also what you're passionate about as well. And that makes it a lot more sustainable.
So Gary, let's talk a little bit about justice. So you guys, mm-hmm. you know, you have eight licenses, or you have licenses across eight states.
Right, that's correct. Yeah.
And so you're in California, you're in Illinois, you're in Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Michigan, Missouri, and Utah. Mm-hmm. You talk to us a little bit about maybe the brands and the markets that are served in those specific states. You don't have to go through all of them, but maybe a little mm-hmm. snapshot.
Yeah, definitely. So we're operational in seven of those states, soon to be eight by the end of the year, which is Massachusetts. You know, so we have vertical licenses, but it's different in each state. So in California, we have cultivation, manufacturing, and distribution. And the brands that we have, so Crops is our flower brand. And so our CEO and a few of the folks that we have on our national corporate team, they come from agricultural backgrounds. So we take a lot of pride in the flower that we're actually creating. So, you know, it's a very persnickety plant and It's not always easy to grow. So we try to do as much as we can to make sure we're getting repeatable high quality flower in every instance that we can. And then Bullet Train is the brand that we have for extracts. And so we have some really good folks that are on the extraction side as well. And so, some areas we're kind of focusing in retail a little bit more. Say, in Missouri, we have 5 dispensaries, and those are under the brand Block, BLOC. That's how we brand it. It's a very unique part of the community. It's part of the block. You're part of the block. You're a dispensary that's right there in the community that serves the folks that are right there. And we want to make sure that we're very active parts of the community as well, and we contribute to a lot of the community efforts that are ongoing. I've been involved in some of these science fairs. We'll put together a booth that talks about the plant science, and I think a lot of folks that they can appreciate what we're trying to do, and it makes it less scary for some folks that are in conservative communities, and they're able to ask questions and very innocuous settings, which is great. In some places, like in New Jersey, we're completely vertical. Where our license includes cultivation, manufacturing, distribution, and then we'll have 3 dispensaries by the end of the year as well.
Awesome. So, Gary, I know we only have a couple minutes left, but one of the things that I wanted to bring up before we break is Austin, Texas recently decriminalized cannabis. And we do hear a lot about Texas and how they really haven't been moving on anything. But, what do you see as the next big thing as far as cannabis legalization and any insight into Texas proper?
Yeah. So we've been doing a lot of work down in Texas lately. And so Texas is very, very unique in that. So there's 3 licensees down there, and we are hoping that they're going to open it back up this summer to allow a few more licensees. We've had some lobbyists down there that are helping us to get access to the governor's office. And so it's kind of an interesting state where you have Abbott, the governor who's he's seemingly not necessarily pro cannabis, but not really against it. And then you have Dan Patrick, who's their lieutenant governor, who's I think a little bit more against it. But those two don't get along very well. And so we've visited a lot of the conservative senators that really kind of run the state house there, and a lot of them say the same thing. They say, "Look, I'm not against it, but in some of these districts that I'm in, I just can't put my name next to anything that's cannabis related, or I'm just not going to get reelected." You try to find some of the folks that are probably a little bit more open to it. There's a Senator Schwenker down there who's a surgeon. And so he really liked what we were doing from a medical standpoint. So he might be someone who can kind of carry the torch for us. But you really, Austin itself, you mentioned Austin decriminalizing, which is great. But Austin really isn't really part of Texas. It's like a different state.
It really is.
So it's very blue in Austin. And so it makes sense that they would do something like this and really kind of sort of, send a message to the rest of the state, to really get in line. And we're hoping to see that they open up the medical program a little bit more. Cause right now, it's a really low THC limit that they allow for, which is, it's only 1%. A lot of the folks that enter into the program don't really stay in the program very long because, it's just not very practical, and a lot of them tend to go over state lines over to New Mexico and in Oklahoma. So it's frustrating to see that when you see so much potential in a state like that. But hopefully, that as they see New Mexico start to make a run with their program, they see Oklahoma and they see some of the surrounding states, then we're hoping that they kind of get on board with it, at least expanding their medical program.
Awesome. Well, Gary, a lot of great insight, and I don't know how you do it all, but appreciate you doing what you do for the whole industry. So, Thanks for coming on the show and giving us some insight there. And everybody, Gary Sealhorse from Justice Cannabis. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. Really appreciate it. And we appreciate what you do as well.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.